Isabel Sanson is getting wired.
When you get old enough, then it's just, it sort of doesn't matter.
You're sitting
there. You can't see either way. I know. I have trifocals.
Bernd Kasparek is still in a... No, he's managed to escape, I think, the interview. Do I see that right? And he's joining us in a second. But without further ado, because we have about half an hour left and so much to discuss, lucky, this was always meant to continue tomorrow, but I can only see that we'll just... sort of collect more pressing issues and then just entirely run out of time. But I would like to begin at the very end to unravel from the back. And the way we do this is we'll start discussing, but you have to entitle yourself to join in. If you have pressing questions or clarifications, make yourselves visible. But I'll start for now by addressing... in a way, the question of citizenship. But Brigitta said at some point that there's no way... when we talk about migration, not only we talk about migration in sort of given in the given framework of its policing, but also in terms of specific ideas of subjectivities, of regulations, it is that which... the emergence of migration as an issue is always within the context of a specific perception of something that could also basically not be named or escape that. And then Isabel said that migrants are made illegals and turned into terrorists. In this sort of construction narrative, you can also reverse, and that there I would like to follow up Ramzi's presentation, because the way what you presented, the so-called Muslim ban, is picking up older policies. And I already pointed to the contribution that we published in German in this supplement for the German newspaper Die Taz, that's also lying around here and available in English online, where you talk about the de facto denaturalizations that have been happening for Yemen American citizens. Now, that is not uncommon. Maybe you recall in France, after the terrorist attacks in Paris, there was this immediate discussion that people should be deported. The idea of denaturalization is part and parcel of what Kim Rügel has called governing through citizenship. And the reason why I'm bringing this in is that not only are migrants turned into terrorists, it's also by means of these kinds of governing through citizenship, people are turned into, they're denaturalized and therefore they're made migrants in the furthest sense. And that's sort of a policy governing through citizenship also shows not only how central migration is to, let's say, the 21st century or to the policies of the nation state or beyond, but also how migration is sort of a testing ground in which these new sort of governing techniques of citizenship are implied or applied or put into practice. And sometimes that's very obvious, even addressed as such. For instance, when they test out new data technologies of control, of surveillance, you do that with the migrant population, because there you can do it, and then it's applied to elsewhere. So I would like to hear, sort of open that up to discuss with you, and I'm sorry, I didn't want to be rude. This moderation is I do together with Brigitta, because Brigitta has such a sort of a clear mind of structuring things when I get lost.
Yeah, well,
no pressure.
Thank you. So that, again, when we talk about migration, we talk beyond migration in the sense that this limitation of how we address something is already part of that sort of problematic. It then becomes clear, you know, that those American citizens are addressed as immigrants. And we know that that has happened in the past years, that people are literally, not only in the United States, addressed in the street, asked, so why are you not going back? It happened after the Brexit vote that people in England, for instance, who spoke Spanish, let's say, in the streets, in public spaces, were addressed as not belonging. Ramzi, maybe that's a direct question to you to expand why the Muslim ban isn't actually something new and where those connections are to the politics of deprivations of citizenship.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if my mic is working.
Yes.
I think the certainly in the United States, when Trump began to speak about extreme vetting for Muslims who are applying for asylum, who are refugees, who are applying for visas, our immediate reaction, at least for those of us who are already working in that space, was to say, well, all of these things that he's describing are already a reality for Muslim-identified immigrants or even permanent residents or citizens, in the sense that under President Obama, far more quietly, with much less overtly racist rhetoric, the U.S. government had achieved very much the same outcomes. And I think Trump himself is going to come to a point where he realizes that he's got these policies that have been there, that have been applied for a good 8 years under President Obama, and that, you know, he can just reclaim, reuse, and maybe repackage and sell rhetorically in a more overtly racist way. But those are fundamentally the same exclusionary and racist policies where, you know, if you're applying for an immigration benefit like naturalization, but you're a Muslim-identified applicant, you're going to be put on a separate track, and your application is going to be denied on any pretext. It's going to be delayed. And that's happening systematically in the United States. You're right to point out that that's not unique to the United States. In the United Kingdom, citizens can be stripped of their citizenship at the unilateral say-so of the interior minister. And if, as long as they're binationals, so as long as they have another citizenship, their UK citizenship can be taken away from them. They can even be executed by drone strike as long as they're outside of the United Kingdom. And that's happened a number of times under Theresa May when she was running the interior ministry in the United Kingdom. France also has denaturalization provisions. What all of this highlights to me, though, is the fragility of the concept of citizenship, the thinness, in an even sort of like larger perspective, the thinness and precariousness of the rule of law, and how easy it is to pierce through these protections that I think people living in so-called industrialized societies wrongly assume are more solid and more resilient than they really are. Because U.S. citizens have been killed by drone strike by their own president. U.K. nationals have been killed by drone strike by their own leadership. People have had their nationality stripped away from them. And as you mentioned, that's happened to Yemenis in the United States, but it's also happened to Dominicans. It's also happened to Mexicans. So what happened to Yemenis, which is what I studied and wrote about and worked on, was really just a reiteration of what had been happening to some Mexicans who live in border communities, Mexican Americans, whose U.S. citizenship was being taken away from them in similar circumstances.
Can I just add to that a little bit? Because I think that what the questions you're raising about being made a migrant or the fragility of citizenship, I think it's important to see the other side of that as well, which is the presumption that the citizen is a unified category within a nation state is deeply problematic. I mean, we can't even begin to understand the racialization of migration and the whole notion of a racial capitalism here or a racial state if we make that presumption that it is only, like, I mean, because you could say from the point of view of African Americans, the migrant is being made a nigger. I mean, that might be the other way to look at it. Excuse the language if you find that offensive, but in that sense, you know, these categories are what it means to be treated as a citizen. We already have multiple forms of partial citizenship. It's, I think, for me important to keep that on the table, especially since so many people here, and I think one of the big issues that was put on the table by almost everyone was the question of resistance, of political struggle, of what the nature of understanding migration as a zone of struggle and conflict is, that we don't want to introduce a binary back into it between the citizen and the non-citizen. So, yeah,
that's actually a very crucial point because, I mean, it's also what, if we refer again to the whole struggle against racist police violence, the Black Lives Matter movement, that there's always been a clear articulation to say that's not new. it was always there in terms of the law didn't protect us. The law was always against us. But I think it is interesting to see how it becomes institutionalized. It's always been there, but under the frame of non-partial citizenship, that is sort of a universal citizenship, and now it's for not now, for a long time, it's been established, I think, as a governing through citizenship, but maybe I'm wrong. I always doubt these articulations of something new in that context. That's also important to look at then the struggles of migration as citizenship, to think what does citizenship consist of?
And also, what will you get when you get it? In other words, this is partially the terms of what the ideological or the political terms of the struggle is. It's one thing to immediately need to have your rights and to get them and be safe and so on. This is part of the distinction I was trying to make between finding the safest place to go and then what you do next, in a sense. So if the struggle around the migrant is to receive the rights of citizenship, the question then is, what are the terms of those? I mean, is that the struggle, full stop, or yeah, what comes next?
It's just maybe a remark that points to the different instances and geographies that have been raised by all the different contributions, and maybe also in relation to the Sandro Mezzadra's the double pincer of state on the one side and capital on the other side, and especially when thinking about the European border, I'm asking myself if we are really talking about the nation state. Let's say, for instance, the European border is already, it's not a national border, it's a supra-state institution. So I'm wondering about the linkage between national governances of migration and something like that maybe could be called transnational or like transnational forms of governing migration that very often fail, but nonetheless they're extremely powerful in place. And I mean, this would be a question maybe to all of you, how you think about this kind of interplay between nation states and post-nation states formation that are already at stake in the contemporary situation of governing migration.
I'll let you speak to the EU case. I was just going to say, from a political scientist perspective, when you talk about global governance, one of the shifts, right, is that what's done in the nation state name is no longer located in the state, right? It's transnationalized. It involves private companies. It involves NGOs. And so, so there's this kind of disaggregation of what the state is, but it does it in defense of state security, but then it's no longer state-based. So I think that is something that shifts the location of where power is and where resistance has to be articulated. Andrew, sorry.
And then, of course, formal aspects within this transnational governance regime, like treaties, cooperation agreements, but there are also informal aspects that are maybe even more important. If you look at an organization like the IOM, International Organization for Migration, you can very easily see how this organization has changed its nature over the last couple of decades. It was a kind of traditional international organization, and now it's a global actor. It It's a global actor that kind of produces standards, knowledge, technical devices that circulate around the globe and that kind of homogenize different migration and border regimes. And the IOM is maybe the best known example, but there are many, many others, many, many others. And as Kim was saying, the role of private actors is more and more prominent. Just think of G4S, I mean, a big corporation which is, active in the field of security services. I mean, G4S is providing these services across the globe. I mean, and again, this has a kind of homogenizing effect. Then there is also the national dimension of every border regime around the world. I mean, and there are often big tensions between the national and the transnational border aspects of the same border regime. I mean, and I think we have to be very careful and attentive in analyzing these tensions that are particularly pronounced nowadays in Europe, I think.
Yeah, just to go on, brief remark on what you said about G4S. It started in Australia in the, the Pacific Solution with a small subsidiary, which was called Australasian Management Facility, and then it grew bigger and bigger and was bought by G4S, and it was involved in the Yards Woods incidents where they were proven fully responsible for the riots, for the management, for the fire also. And they are also on the US-Mexican borders and things like that. So they are a transnational actor, multinational actor, which is as important as the nation state. Just maybe you can correct me, Sandro, if I'm wrong, but you were talking about formal and informal. When I was mentioning the fact that the EU-Turkey agreement was not an agreement anymore, but there is also with, I will say, your Italian migration compact. We are on another, okay, the Italian migration compact was a term which was coined by Renzi, I guess, huh? In 2016. It's another form. Before, we had formal agreements with several provisions. We have to capacity building, human rights, economic development, and also protecting the borders, which of course became the main objective. Now, with the Migration Compact of Italy, with people, countries from the Horn of Africa, there's not even that. It's just a whole bunch of money provided by European fiduciary funds, and then whoever comes first grabs it and do the job, whether Nigeria or Sudan or things like that. So there's not even what we had before in kind of readmission agreements or things like that. It's, I think it's a shifting, I don't know, the lawyers maybe can correct me, but I think it's a whole shift also of informal agreements.
I like what you said about the tensions between the national and the transnational, because sometimes I think this is what makes the whole study of the European border regime interesting, because when you just had an assortment of, say, 27 national states, there was a point why there are these hydraulic notions of migration, that it's like a tap you can turn on, you can open the borders, you can close it. And especially that closing part, because you can always say, I raise the bar to cross into the territory, people will go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Now, if you move on to a supranational structure like the European Union, you can't do this anymore. And this is the struggles and the conflicts inside the European border regime of the last 15 years is exactly that, that certain states say, we have no problems of keeping our borders open because people will transit. We have no problem with transit. And so I think the big logic behind what is the European border regime is then you have to invent yourself again as an imagined community which is negatively affected by migration, so that all of these member states suddenly stand up together and find a common policy that there is no transit anymore, that there's, you know, that you have a shared responsibility of the border, which is something which didn't even exist 30 years ago, something like a European border. And this tension, I find, is very, very interesting. And is contrasted, just to say one sentence, it is contrasted with this notion of the European citizenship, which was never really properly developed. So if you want to be an emergent community, you would need something like a European citizenship. But it was historically just in the 1993 Maastricht Treaty, and they said, well, you know, we'll stamp it on everybody's passport, but it doesn't mean anything. And that's also a fundamental disregard, of course, of citizenship.
Can I just ask a little bit to put another tension on the table that, Sandra, you articulated originally between capital and state, and that also would bring, I think, Birgitta's presentation about a seventh man in as well. And that has to do with that tension. I mean, just a really shorthand for this in the U.S. context is that responsibility for immigration was under the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor until the Second World War, when it moved to the Justice Department, primarily in order to intern Japanese and German residents and citizens. That's why it moved to the Justice Department, so it could become a policing function, like the Interior Ministry would be the equivalent here. And it didn't move to Homeland Security until 2001. So the elaborate buildup of transnational security border agreements beyond Interpol and the minimal kinds of bilateral agreements that existed between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, or between France and England, or so on and so forth, people out of Schengen then, this has all changed dramatically. And what seems to me really striking is that there is now very much a tension between the things that drive the state and a certain kind of will to power and reducibility there, and its previous handmaiden function for the movement of labor and capital. And it seems to me there's a fundamental tension going on here that partially gets embedded in the buildup of these border or military industrial security complexes. But I'm interested in all of you folks who are thinking about that tension to perhaps how you're thinking about that tension also between the state is no longer simply doing that work any longer in a simple kind of way, which is the scene, for example, in Europe that Berger is writing about, right? The guest worker programs, and it's very different now. Yeah, I mean, everyone over here has been, what have you been talking about that?
That sounds like it's going to be continued, but maybe I always keep looking into the audience. If you have a question or you want to, I know there's, yeah? Oh, it would be great also move here so we can actually see you.
It's
yeah, please.
Yeah.
Timothy Snyder actually talked a lot, you see, about statelessness and how it affected people in his Black Earth history book. Now, the other thing, of course, you see, is the problem of slavery. We know, you see, that in the United States, slavery actually went straight into Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Then we had civil rights. But as a matter of fact, of course, it has not actually totally changed. The question is really, I mean, are there some kind, you see, of remnants of slavery that affect people? It certainly actually is a question that one can ask, especially in relationship to African Americans, and of course, I mean, to Haiti, which of course was the first attempt to do away, you see, with slavery, which of course Napoleon actually then rescinded, because Josephine came from a plantation owner family, so that was taken away. And I one day see whether we actually do not have persistence of forms of slavery that actually have to be traced. I mean, CNN, interestingly, I mean, talks a lot about human trafficking and slavery and Freedom Day and things like that. But it does that mainly metaphorically. And I wonder, you see, whether we actually have the right to look at, you see, as just being only a metaphor.
Is that maybe something directed to you? Would you like to respond?
Yes. Well, of course, the question of slavery haunts debates surrounding migration. There are many instances of forced migration in the world that can be compared to historical forms of slavery. I am much more skeptical regarding the generalization of these instances and regarding the possibility of kind of equating what's going on in the Mediterranean Sea nowadays with the Middle Passage, with the Atlantic slave trade. You may know that this comparison circulates widely among policymakers and politicians. And in a way, it is used in order to prompt military operations that presumably should target traffickers, slave traders, as they are called, but end up targeting migrants. A couple of years ago, there was a very powerful statement promoted in the UK by scholars engaged in the study of historical forms of slavery. And this was a statement against the comparison between what happens in the Mediterranean and the Middle Passage. Having said this, I would kind of propose to take a wider view on the topic. I mean, on the one hand, you have instances of forced migration that recall slavery. On the other hand, you have this kind of political and rhetorical use of the comparison with the Middle Passage. But I think we should get kind of wider perspective and talk about let's say, the specter of forced labor that haunts migration nowadays and through migration has effects on dependent labor at large. So this is short, but I hope clear.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it raises again the question how you relate to history. The question was addressed to slavery, something from the past. It asks the question, what is the present of it? And I think in a way, but I think that will pick up tomorrow, it also addresses those established narratives of victimization and what is actually to be gained from that in the context of a kind of humanitarian policies around migration that are just pure evil, to put it simply. But it, I guess we can use that also as a segue to use the remaining time that we have to shift to something that might have been very striking, not striking, obvious without being addressed per se, that in all of the presentations, and that's not just because they were presentations, there's images. John Burgess and Jean Maure's book consists largely of images, and you described how that was a method of applying very different approaches, and also to let, I think, in the and the opening, the foreword. They say how they also want them to speak for themselves. Now, ever you used a set of images that you didn't further expand on, and one we could see that there were the contrabands if we kind of raised our glasses. but I would like to use that because, in a way, if we talk about how we talk about migration, we do that within the frame of how do we actually, what do we see, right? And how is that perspective? And of course, you could address, we can talk about this question of fugitivity, also in the sense of becoming imperceptible. But generally, it's a question of that also happens in the realm of representation, or very much so. Maybe you would ask that that question differently, but I would like to go into that to talk about the fact that we all worked with images and what those what the role of those images. And maybe you could start because sure. you let the images speak for themselves
I did. I will say where they're from if people want to know. I mean, those images were taken by Timothy O'Sullivan, who famously photographed the many things in addition to the Civil War in the United States. He actually also photographed the settling of the West once the frontier was closed as well. But he took thousands of photographs of the war, and especially they are the only photographic archive we have of the fugitive slaves and of the camps that the enslaved people who left the plantations established outside and around the military bases, the Union Army camps. And I partially wanted to show them for two reasons. One is because in the last images that I showed, one was just the Savannah River, which was routinely crossed. It's what are you looking at? I mean, that was in effect a border between what wasn't a nation yet, but what was in the war to create one. And so that was a border, you could say. But what is there to see when you're looking at that? And then the last image, because it struck me as so ambiguous as to when it was taken. So that's a 19th century image. That image was taken in 1862. But it could have been taken in Calais. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, there are little things in the image that would tell you you're looking in the 19th century. But if you just look at it quickly, it looks like it could be there. The tents are same, the kerosene lamps, the caps, and so on. And so it was partially just to create a kind of visual register there and to, in some ways, raise the representational question that I liked in Khalili's piece, but that I think is an important one that also people, everybody here raised too in some ways, which is how to render the importance, significance, meaningfulness, the centrality of the individual people who are in this condition, who are moving, who are fleeing, who are suffering, who are deciding to walk from, you know, 230 kilometers and so on. What are the terms of representing that are not necessarily caught up in these other frameworks, you know, of the humanitarian appeal, of what Sandra was just talking about, where we identify the evil slave traders and the people movers. And I mean, there's a whole panoply of processes that are being shown to people and then are to, like, what are the terms of the critique? So to me, in some ways, the closest images to the ones I think that I showed were Isabel's maps, mm-hmm. were the forensic architecture's maps. I would say they are closest in representational alliance, those maps, which are rendering abstractions in a particular way. That's very precise about the movement of the people.
So I have this thing. Okay. Maybe it's not only a question of representation, but maybe of anti-representation. I'm part of an authors collective, you know, Gastarbeiters, guest workers, we are reading like autobiographical texts, you know, from about parents, about childhood, and so on. And early on, we kind of decided to not go along the documentary path. Don't display typical worker surrounding, you know, working class fetishism, so to speak. But go radically subjective. I don't know, 70s grandma doing something in the kitchen or so, and present totally subjective stories that kind of hijack the relevance of telling, anecdotes from this official narrative of how Gastarbeiters, guest workers are supposed to look like in images. So it's kind of capturing some master narratives, migration master narratives, and putting it bluntly into a totally privatized story. So basically, in the prose, what the grandma says becomes the most important thing in German history or so, to put it bluntly. So the reaction to that from the audience is kind of revealing. Sometimes they come in and expect kind of to go out depressed, so because, you know, it's this terrible story. But suddenly they laugh all the time, and because the stories are kind of what you call tragic-comical sort of, this is kind of liberating experience when you kind of fight with the image, actually, and not just giving up to it. Mm. Know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think that's actually very key. When I was speaking about representation, I meant that in the triple sense of representation, right? In terms of imagination, of political representation, and now, of course, I'm having a blank. The point being, what in Escape Routes? Yeah, there's another. The point being that in Escape Routes by Vasilis Tsianos and Dimitris Papadopoulos, they speak about what they call the double R axiom. That is how representation and sort of the political are rights and representation are live in a conjunction. And how that attains to migration. It's very clear that the way we talk about migration is also, as you once argued, is formatted on screens. And representation isn't just that which shows us what happens elsewhere. So there's migration, then we put it on the screen. It actually formats how we talk about it, and that's why. And that anti-representational move is exactly what you also started with by saying the undoing of a specific aesthetics or a specific formatting is key. So where was that?
Hi, yeah? Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject and build on some of the discussions which were mentioned around Hungary's long summer of migration. And it was very interesting. I was living in Hungary at the time to see Western media coverage of the Hungarian deficit of compassion, as some people call it, with specific reference to the 1956 refugee crisis after the invasion of Hungary. Mm. And I was wondering whether you thought at the current kind of juncture of right populist politics, this kind of attempt to talking about representation, this attempt to frame a kind of moral sense of identification with migrants in national narratives is a kind of uniquely Jetztzeit der Monster kind of issue, because it's something which I see rising particularly in Eastern Europe with the Visegrad countries' response to refugees, attempts to find possible locuses of solidarity within those countries' histories. So I wondered if you might mention that briefly.
That's Bernd.
Bernd?
That's Bernd.
Precisely. Do you have the question precisely?
Okay, let me ask him.
Sorry. I didn't get the question 100%. Oh, I'm afraid I might miss the point. So would you mind?
Just very briefly, like to the
The point is the as I see it, rising use of kind of national narratives and understandings of our suffering as Europeans based on 1945 history to kind of as an attempt to draw solidarity at a time when there's very little with people coming from the Middle East. That's a big point in European solidarity and discourse, I think.
I'm not sure if this really happens, this comparison. Sometimes I'm in situations where I wonder that it pops up. So there's a kind of right-wing political foundation which likes to invite me to talk about European refugee policies because they don't find anybody else to talk about it. And that was like 2 years ago, and I ended up in the seminar, and I think the youngest person there was probably 65. And I was expecting for like a hard time fighting about what is going on in Europe. That was before the summer. What really amazed me was that they were all saying, yes, this happened to us as well. When I see these images of people sleeping in the streets of Munich, let's say, they say, this is what happened to us as well. So that really confused me, because normally I do not detect this so very much. Concerning the documentary is, like I butchered it a little bit, because it's much longer, like nearly 20 minutes, and there are very strong scenes about solidarity from the people. There's actually this very moving, tragicomic scene where a guy in a suit comes out to the and on the highway and says, "Please, can I give water to these people?" And he turns to the camera and says, "I have never helped anybody in my life, but I know this is what needs to be done, and it feels good." And you wonder, like, who says that about himself? But so there are very good scenes about that as well. But for me, it was important, I think, that we yes, there is this narrative around the Willkommenskultur, the welcoming culture, and how well Germany has performed on that way. And so I find we have to detach ourselves a little bit from that narrative, not because it's wrong, because there are really all over Europe networks of solidarity which are working very hard and which are not present in the media anymore, but I know that they are still there. Yes, but I think I would also see the danger if that turns into a new like national or supranational European narrative, because it's not that mainstream in the end.
I think there were two more questions, and then we anyway run out of time. Have to continue tomorrow. Please.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask something about the kind of special temporal position that was kind of... maybe can be traced to all the speakers, but with different mentions. When talking about genealogy of migration, if you wish, I wonder when you start tracing the temporal and the spatial. Do you start tracing the temporal, if you wish, when does the summer start? Does it start with arrival to Europe? Does it start when Syrian migrants were hosted in the millions in Lebanon? And the same way goes to the spatial, to the location of migration and to the different border regimes. And I wonder how within that idea you can open up the discourse regarding migration. Where is the subject of migration is located? Is it located in Europe, in the US, in the border between Mexico and the US, in the Mediterranean? Should it be located in 2011 or in certain summer? Or maybe we can speak about other borders, for example, the Eritrean, Sudanese-Ethiopian border and the different regimes that are happening there and the different notion of state citizenship and nationalism.
I mean, generally, the idea wasn't to make those examples universal or to place, to say that is what migration is, but to start from the materiality. Also as an approach just to see what we're talking about, right? That we know what are the events that we refer to in their specificities. But would you like to respond to that? So, to this question, because it was such a specific question, when did the summer begin?
Okay, let me start with the spatiality. I think we had a little research we had a research project last year, and I think if we saw one thing is that put it like this, the regime doesn't have a border because it does really stretch. But we had to go until the, not me personally, but in the, of the team, we had to go until the Syrian border to understand how things are connected. And I think one thing we found, which is something we need to highlight, there is, if we talk about migration and the specific situation we're in, there always seems to be this polarity between Europe on the one hand and Turkey on the other hand. And I think it's very important to bridge this because really, at least through the EU-Turkey deal, and despite its apparent fragility, it is really stable if you look at it. But what does that mean? That really means that we are in one continuous space in which this regime is operating. So so much for the spatial question. And for the temporal question, I would say the summer started, for me, the summer started in spring when we started to understand the first stories about more people, like in April, for example, or in March or in April 2015, there were the first reports about refugees and migrants transiting Macedonia by foot on the train tracks. There was one particular case where a train hit a group of people traveling, 40 people died, which is a very tragic case in itself, but it was already the first inkling, you might say, that something was on the move. So, and then of course it continued throughout the summer, and I think the interesting part of 2015 is that the whole of Europe, of course, was looking to Greece, but refused to see that what was going on because it was all about the euro crisis, which was then, well, not resolved, but put to death somehow in June and July. And but there is a specific time period before the summer, which is very, very important for what was going on eventually.
And I guess using that term is also a way to refuse to speak about the so-called refugee crisis, right? To take a discourse and to rename it and to say what's actually going on. Of course, it implies the one summer, but I often use the long summer because then it just it extends. Right, from that specific year or those 2 years that it refers to. But I guess the question you're asking is also one of recognition. And that's another, one of the, when we prepared for this, Brigitta and I were discussing that the language in which migration is addressed is that of crisis often, or of the moment, right? Something that happens all of a sudden that I tried to speak about in the introduction. And while migration is always there, it's always there. It's the most, it's, let's say it's actually the most normal, it's everywhere and it's always there. And no matter what the attempts of its regulation, it is there. And then that, but it asks, and this sort of, the problem with this sort of moments of the emergent, of the sudden, of the surprise, is both, of course, because the language of crisis allows for a certain installment of governing technologies, but also, we can also understand it as a form of disruption of the narrative of the sort of the history of the nation state, right? Something is wrong in that continuous narrative. But what happens, how do we look at that, the fact that things appear to be in, as you said, they're in the media and then they disappear. If you talk about the summer of migration, it's striking how it's all of a sudden gone from the long time of, like, from that, from media, but also from things like, I sit in juries for small art grants. 1 year, pretty much every project is about the refugees. Second, the next year, one out of 200 maybe. I'm just saying that, of course, there's these economies or Konjunkturen in German, like something sort of comes to the surface and disappears. But the question is, what do we, like, do we address the media? Do we address, what is that moment of recognition, right? And what does it mean to understand that which sort of migration being there anyways, and that knowledge that circulates outside of specific forms of official recognition of knowledge, for instance. But that's, I guess, I think there was one last question, is that right?
I can intervene quickly.
You can say the closing words.
The closing word.
No. What? Just a very brief remark.
I take the last one before the closing, and yeah. you do the closing. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not closing anything. It's just a remark. Go.
To me, just Marc Auger's term "non-space" is turned up. You know, for centuries, the sovereignty of a nation state was defined by who has the right to declare a state of emergency. And it seemed in the summer or wherever, there was a kind of overwhelming, this was a state of emergency that was not declared by state, but by groups of people. And that was, I think, one of the reasons why this whole notion of endangered nations came up and so on, because they thought, oh, something is wrong. So, and non-spaces, I also refer to this. You know, there are lots of films that deal with that. No Man's Land, you know, spaces that are simply not defined. I think there's, till this day, there's a little piece of land, between Bosnia and Croatia, that has not been, that's kind of left out of negotiations. They forgot about it. And there's a Slovakian... a former politician who claimed land and declared a little country in there. You know, I think it's maybe as big as this hall. I don't know how big exactly. So to me, this is also interesting that these non-spaces and that challenge kind of the notion, because everything is kind of declared and regulated, so to speak, in a certain way, and then certain events happen. And things open up. And another point of non-spaces or in-between spaces is the, you know, the customs area itself, which seems to be also a kind of regulated state of emergency, because as far as I know, you should know better that. You cannot, if you are called by the customs agents, you cannot have a lawyer or something. As a foreigner, as a non U.S. citizen, as far as I know. So this, to me, as a layman, it seems to me a kind of lawless area. Also, it's a strange area. When you want to travel to the U.S., you have no right to, you know, if they have search you or whatever, as a foreigner, you have no rights more or less. It seems to me. So this seems to me also an area where you could define as a non-space, non-official space. There's a film with Tom Hanks, I think, yeah. Where he hangs around at the airport, I think, for days or something.
Yeah, it's based on a real character. Brigitte could talk about this case, and Tom Hanks, the actor for the... like the white owning of victimizations.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the perfect cast for a Hollywood version of that real story. But in the negative sense.
Yeah.
Isabel, last words to close this panel.
I'm not sure I'm going to close, but what? I was...
We open it up for tomorrow and for later.
No, I was reflecting on what you and Avery said about what do we see, the representation, and Avery mentioned Calais, and I was reminded that at least in France, but the policy about the migration policy, about Calais and the migration policy at large, is a question of visibility, invisibility. The Sangat camp in 1999 was created because there were migrants from Cherbourg to Belgian border. So we put them in a camp, which was an open camp, but a camp whatsoever. And then they became visible again, because every night they went to the Calais harbor to try to get a boat. So there were the camp was closed, they were dispersed in the jungle, and then in the squats, and they were evicted, and more police violence, and it's, okay, and now the jungle has been destroyed with a special vocabulary. It's the same thing happening in Paris, I think it's the same thing happening everywhere. So what do we see? Wow. The state or the nation state or the European state want to make the migrants invisible.
And what is made invisible with what you see. So
of course.
When you see this at Calais, you don't see that is where the UK border is.
Mm-hmm.
This is.
No. Yeah.
And you don't see the sans-papiers. Okay, so those earlier links, in an earlier moment, this question that the woman asked about space and time, it puts the challenge on us to respond to both Sandra and Nana's call that we begin to write these histories of migration as kind of the history of the present. That's how I understood both of you were making this call.
But that is very difficult. And then the question of the relationship between these global patterns or transnational patterns and the local, the locality of it, the literally I am going from here to there on my 2 feet, you know, carrying my children and my things, means that this relationship between this big, if you like, global border crossing processes and the actual histories embedded in the lives of individuals, it's very difficult to answer these questions you asked. I think it's a good challenge to leave us with what the writing of that history might actually involve.
Some continuation later tonight by the discussion on the zones of the free zones and the zones of exclusion with Bernd Kasparek, Kim Rügel, and Keller Easterling. And then we also continue tomorrow. Thank you, Brigitta, Isabel, Bernd, Sandro, Kim, Avery, Zoran, and Ramzi. And thanks to all of you for staying with us for 4 hours and then some. And yeah, let's continue in about 45 minutes with the next session, not on migration, but. And I hope I see you all tomorrow for talking more about migration. Thank you.